everybody. My name is Tom Whitman. I teach in the Department of Music and Dance here. I want to welcome you to the annual Peter Graham Swing Lecture. Peter Graham Swing was the founder of this department, and he was a mentor, one of my great mentors in my life as a student at Swarthmore. And I'm particularly delighted to say that Elizabeth and Pamela Swing are here today for this lecture. We're very honored that they're able to come. It's a special pleasure for me and also an honor for me to introduce Marie Abe, who is a student of mine here. As you can see and will see, has gone on to do some absolutely extraordinary things. Marie holds an MA and PhD in ethnomusicology from the University of California, Berkeley, and a degree in sociology, anthropology, and ethnomusicology from Swarthmore College, is what it says on her website. Her scholarship explores politics of space and sound, critical cultural theory, and Japanese popular performing arts. Other research interests include cultural advocacy, ritual music in Bali and Thailand, the global circulation of tango, the accordion in immigrant communities in California, anti-nuclear movement and music in Japan, and Afrofuturism in the United States. Before coming to Boston University, Professor Abe taught in the Department of Music and Asian Studies program at UC Berkeley and in the Department of Anthropology at Harvard University, where she was a postdoctoral fellow at the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies. She is currently working on a book-length ethnographic analysis of Shindonya, am I saying that right? A live musical advertisement practice in Japan. She's also a co-producer of the NPR radio documentary Squeezebox Stories, premiered in fall 2011, which tells stories from Californian immigration history using the accordion as a common trope. Marie is an active performer of the accordion and piano. By the way, she was a student of Marc Antonio Brones when she was here and put on one of the memorable, most memorable senior recitals we've ever had in my time at Swarthmore College. Before she moved on to the accordion. With the frequent concert tours and collaborations with recording artists from the United States and Japan, she is currently performing with the Boston-based Ethiopian groove collective Debo Band, Sub Pop / Next Ambience, which have been featured in the New York Times, Rolling Stone magazine, NPR, and other media. She's going to talk to us today on ethnomusicology on air, accordion, cultural advocacy, and immigrant experiences in California. Please welcome Marie.
Work with issues of cultural diversity, geography, and multiculturalism in much of my work. been a big music fan since I was 3 when I started taking piano lessons. As I have navigated across geographical and social cultural lines, music has always been a window through which I've reflected on my place in society, related with others in profound ways, and learned about their stories. While some stories carry traces of inequality and violence, music can also be a powerful instrument to challenge the status quo. It's this insight that I strive to instill in my work as an ethnomusicologist, educator, and a musician. How engaged and critical listening helps us hear invisible social relations, silenced memories, and distant places, and how active performance and musical interactions with others inspire creative social intervention. The seeds for these insights were planted right here at Swarthmore. It was at Swarthmore where I found ways to integrate parts of me that I felt to be fragmented from growing up in different parts of the world. While I was here, I learned to synthesize my diverse interests that initially seemed incommensurable, to appreciate the productive tension within the intersection of being an artist and an academic, and to conceive scholarly projects as a form of public engagement. So, it seems only fitting to me that I'm presenting today on a project that took me outside of my primary expertise, which is Japan, politics of sound and affect in public space in Japan. And instead, I'd like to share with you my work today on this ethnographically informed public radio documentary that I collaboratively produced with a radio journalist, which pushed me outside of my comfort zone, challenged me to integrate new modes of creative and scholarly expressions, and engage with new audiences. So let me begin with playing you a short excerpt.
I'm Marco Werman of PRI's The World. Welcome to Squeezebox Stories, a musical and social history of the accordion. In the next hour, we'll visit Zydeco dance halls and Mexican Norteño clubs, punk rock apprentices, and Arabic master musicians, all to discover what's behind the surprisingly wide appeal of this ultimate people's instrument.
For the accordion, that's the only instrument you hug. It becomes part of your body. When I carry my accordion, all my shyness goes away.
The accordion, it's not just that it's been in different hands or played differently by different people. It's been the meaningless. It's been the crossroads.
And man, that sound just hits you.
Join us for a musical journey with the accordion. First, this news.
How's the volume? Raise it, yeah? So this is a 60-minute public radio documentary that I produced in collaboration with journalist and a good friend of mine, Julie Kane, titled Squeezebox Stories. Squeezebox Stories tells five different stories about immigration histories in California using the accordion as a common thread. And my talk today will focus exclusively on the last of the five stories. But to give you a quick overview of the entire hour, the first story profiles Vin Cirelli, an Italian-American accordion repairman in his 90s, and Skyla Fell, a woman in her early 30s who is apprenticing with him to learn the craft. The second story highlights a TV host and accordionist, Lawrence Welk, whose show simultaneously popularized and stigmatized the instrument. This story shows how accordion at first became a tool for assimilation, a symbol of whiteness, and subsequently a stigmatized object signifying the old Europe. The third story, about African Creole musician Andre Theory, tells how Zydeco traveled all the way across the country from Louisiana to California, together with the internal migration of the Creoles in the 1950s, and how this accordion-driven dance music provides a home away from home for them living in Richmond, California. The fourth story is about the Lebanese classical accordionist Elias Lama, for whom accordion isn't a folk instrument, but an instrument of prestige that requires a lifetime to master. And in this story, I also talk about how he physically has to modify the instrument so that he can play the quarter tones in Arabic scale. And our last Squeezebox story, the segment that I'll be expanding on later today, is from California's Central Valley. A vast agricultural region where many indigenous Mexicans from the state of Oaxaca have recently find work in fields. And this is also the area where there is a major drought happening right now in the news. It shows how the accordion provides a new creative facet for Oaxacan workers to negotiate their sense of self in the new land, within the indigenous Oaxacan community, Mexican community, and within the United States. So some of you may be wondering how I came to conceive of this project. And even more people might be wondering, why the accordion? And I'm curious, who here plays the accordion? Look at this, this is great. Some fans, so obviously some fans, some haters. It's okay. It's great, okay. I'm in a safe place today. And I'm sure some of you may also have some accordion stories, right? Uncle plays the accordion, or you found an accordion in an attic, something like that, okay. Well, the radio documentary, me, was born when I first met the collaborator, Julie Kane, at a dinner. Upon finding out that I am an accordionist, she asked me, okay, I have to ask, why is the accordion everywhere? While many Americans may associate the accordion with polka or whiteness, Julie, as an avid fan of vernacular music from around the world, knew that the accordion indeed is a global instrument. The accordion in its contemporary form was first created in Europe in the early 1800s. Accordions were originally developed as a much cheaper alternative. There is some dispute over where the first accordion was made and who invented it. But an instrument called accordion was first patented by a man called Cyril Demian in 1829 in Austria. And this is a photo of an accordion, sort of similar, not exactly the one he invented, but similar from that time. The accordion was the musical instrument of the Industrial Revolution. Accordion was mass-produced, making it much more accessible to individuals. Instruction books could be sold, so the forms of playing it could be regularized and standardized. You didn't need to have networks of apprenticeship and instruction for the accordion. So in some ways, it had both the standardizing but also democratizing features of the industrial age. Since its inception, it has spread throughout the world through the forces of European expansion, colonialism, and migration in the following century. The accordion was an ideal instrument for the mass migrations of the 19th century. That instrument was portable, loud, and relatively easy to play. It also worked as a one-man band, playing melody and harmony at once. As people left Europe for the New World, they brought their accordions with them. Consequently, the United States quickly became the main importer of accordions. Today, you can find the instrument in places from Madagascar, South Africa, Ethiopia, Egypt, Lebanon, Afghanistan, China, Colombia, Brazil, North America, all over Western and Eastern Europe, and beyond. So just to show you the variety of accordions, this is the kind of it's the button accordion most common in Mexican norteño music or in Colombia, and it's diatonic in that depending on which way you're bellowing, the same button makes two different notes, pitches. And this is a very typical Cajun accordion, also diatonic. And this one is very, very, very popular in France. This is chromatic, but the right hand is all buttons. And this is this might be the one that's most familiar to you. It's a piano accordion, and it's either way you're bellowing, same key produces. And this is another accordion, a piano accordion. So one thing to note is that in the 1930s, accordion wasn't as widely available. It was still something that you would see on the Babo stage. So it was really ornate. It was really well decorated. And the little curly sides are very characteristic of this era. But soon after that, it became more cheaply produced, but also widely available. And that's how we came to this black and a little bit more minimum. So the dinner conversation about the history of the accordion with Julie led to more exchanges, collaborative research, and eventually a grant from the California Council for the Humanities, the state branch of the National Endowment for the Humanities. To produce a radio documentary, we spent 2 years doing field work. We interviewed over 100 people who were accordion people in one way or another across California, including musicians, fans, and a few haters, repairmen and women, teachers, and festival organizers. It only took us a few months before we started to see various narrative patterns emerge. Some have their bag of accordion jokes ready, and I'm sure many of you share more with you afterwards in Q&A if you're interested. Some hated the accordion passionately because it was imposed on them as a child against their will. I also heard a few lost accordion stories where people told of painful and unfortunate separations from their instruments and miraculous reunion with their beloved object many years later, sometimes decades later. Some people call it the devil's instrument, an instrument that has magical power to lure certain people. Another recurring theme was closet stories. Many of the great musicians we met along the way shared with us how they felt an inexplicable attraction to the instrument, which was forbidden or supposed to be somebody else's job in the family. As a result, they snuck around, practiced in secrecy, sometimes literally while hiding in a closet, until they eventually gained recognition as a passionate and accomplished accordionist. So from these stories, we started to wonder, what is it about this instrument that produces these narratives? Why is there this mythical quality about these narratives about the accordion? One thing was clear, this musical instrument, this sturdy material object made of wood and thousands of intricate parts made of metal, beeswax, and deer leather, does something to people. It elicits affective responses, memories, and creative expressions from the performers, listeners, and instrument makers. In his recent article, ethnomusicologist Elliot Bates takes on this precise question about the materiality and agency of musical instruments. He asks, how do we think about a musical instrument as not only central to human social networks, but also an actor with a kind of agency? Showing how certain musical instruments not only facilitate, prevent, or mediate social interactions, but also create desire and affect, Bates draws our attention to musical instruments' capacity for action. Rather than a study of musical instruments as simply passive artifacts from which sound emanates, Bates calls for a study of the social life of musical instruments that examines, quote, the performative and integrative capacity of things to help make what we call society, end quote. So this is what he's calling the social life of musical instruments. So he does this by expanding what the social means. He theorizes the social to include people, animals, material objects, spaces, and ideas and concepts. In other words, going beyond a semiotic mode of analysis of material culture, Bates is advocating for relational analysis of musical instruments as agentful actors within the paradigm that encompasses the full range of possible, quote, human-object-divine relations, end quote. I find Bates' claim very compelling. His rather provocative model certainly resonates with many of the stories, narratives, and interactions I witnessed in the course of producing the documentary. However, I maintain a certain level of reservation also. Broadly speaking, various theorists who inform Bates' ideas espouse a worldview that erases the divide between human subjectivity and objects. And in this object-oriented ontology, human subjectivities and objects are flattened onto the same terrain. While this view allows us to pay attention to how objects have affective impact on us beyond the discursive realm, implicit in it is an anti-humanist commitment that risks negating the process of signification. How do we reconcile these desires to privilege both the agency of objects and humanist impulse to encode objects with meanings? How can we pay attention to the social life of the accordion without discounting human subjectivities and cultural poetics at the same time? I'd like to hold on to this question and tension as I move through my talk today, and I'll revisit it at the end. So these theoretical questions aside, as some of the accordion narratives demonstrated, the stories in the documentary are ethnographic testament to these active capacities of the instrument in the shaping of social and cultural life in distinct cultural contexts. The accordion became more than a mere instrument, metaphorical trope, or narrative device. The accordion became a powerful object through which to examine immigration histories and memories, shifting discourse of ethnic identities in the U.S., and cultural imaginaries of their senses of belonging. So now, let me tell you more about the Oaxacan story from the documentary in order to think through the social life of a musical instrument and examine how the accordion has produced new creative and political possibilities among the Oaxacan migrant communities in the Central Valley, California.
Okay.
parts of the United States, when you scan the radio, you're very likely going to hear something like this. This is norteño music, and it's a big part of mainstream Mexican culture in the United States. Flashy button accordions are always a centerpiece, and it's what many people from Mexico listen to. The face of Mexican immigration is changing, however, and the music is changing along with it. The latest wave of immigrant farm workers in California are indigenous people from the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. Many of this most recent wave of immigrants don't even speak Spanish as their first language. Producers Julie Kane and Marie Abe went to California's Central Valley in search of a new kind of accordion music.
So begins the last segment of the documentary. As Wright Hooter's 2010 collaboration with the Mexican group Los Tigres del Norte raised the profile of norteño music in mainstream U.S. popular imagination, the accordion has reaffirmed its status musical signifier of not only the genre of norteño, but also the Mexican population in the U.S. at large. Elided in such a monolithic conception of Mexican-American population in the U.S. are the recent waves of indigenous migrants from Oaxaca, southern Mexico, for whom the accordion has little to do with their regional pride. Starting in the 1970s, and particularly since the 1990s, indigenous peoples from Oaxaca, such as Mixtecs and Zapotecs, migrated in large waves to the U.S. An overwhelmingly majority of Oaxaca migrants chose Southern California as their destination, although some others find themselves in Midwest and Northeast. But by the 1990s, an estimated 50,000 Mixtec farm workers resided in California, particularly concentrating in the Central Valley. Leading to the term Oaxaca, California to refer to the transnational space occupied by the indigenous Oaxacans living in the state. According to the Indigenous Farm Worker Study, indigenous Oaxacans are the fastest growing farm worker population in California, and the most recent estimated figure places the minimum population between 100,000 and 150,000, representing between 20 and 30% of the California's entire farm labor force. And this is sort of a typical view of the field that they work on. It's this vast monocultural field, and this is for the grapes to produce raisins. Both in the US and Mexico, indigenous Oaxacans find themselves marginalized, economically, socially, and politically, as migrants and as indigenous people. In addition to the well-known obstacles that confront cross-border migrants in the US, especially those without documentation, indigenous Oaxacans also face entrenched racist attitudes and discrimination from other Mexicans, who mock them for their rural ways, their heavily accented Spanish or inability to speak it, and their low level of education. For many of these migrants from Oaxaca, one of the things that provide them with a sense of home is chilena, the region's beloved musical style. One of our interlocutors, Carlos Mendoza, expressed this sentiment when speaking of the musical genre to us, quote, "In Oaxaca, we have many regions, but there's one thing that unites all Oaxacans, that we all have the same love for this kind of music," meaning chilena. "We all identify ourselves with this kind of music." Chilena is believed to have been introduced to Oaxaca by Chilean sailors who came through Oaxaca on their way to seek fortune in American gold rush. And I'm gonna play you an example. Local audiences through home recordings, live performances, and radio, even reaching their home communities in southern Mexico via satellite broadcasts. How did this improbable combination of the Oaxacan traditional genre of chilena, sonic index of the southern state, and the accordion, sonic signifier of northern Mexico, become possible? What kind of histories and relations during the migration process across the border created conditions in which this unthinkable sounds become audible? Musical practices like chilena provide a great platform from which to understand the formation of diasporic subjectivity. However, I am less interested today in providing a larger narrative about formation of an Oaxacan collective identity. Instead, I am more interested in teasing out the diverse and sometimes conflicting creative, social, and economic aspirations among Oaxacan farm workers who play and dance to these renditions of chilena on the accordion. So to do so, I will focus on three actors who play central roles in the emergence of this musical phenomenon: a radio DJ and activist, an accordionist slash producer, and a chilena band, all of whom live near Fresno, California. So the first actor. Fidelmo Lopez came to the US during the 1980s, part of one of the earliest waves of Oaxaca migration. Now in his late 60s, he speaks Spanish with a Mixtec accent. In 1995, Lopez started the first and only Mixtec language weekly radio program in the US called La Hora Mixteca, the Mixtec Hour, in order to, quote, orient and organize Mixtec community and foster indigenous identity. The show has now grown into a four-hour program broadcast on the U.S.'s only Spanish public radio station, Radio Bilingüe, transmitted from Fresno to locations throughout the U.S. and many parts of Mexico. La Hora Mixteca was groundbreaking in several ways. For one, under Mexico's ban on the public display of indigenous languages, which lasted from the Spanish colonization in the 16th century until the early 1990s, gaining Mixtec presence on the airwaves was an achievement in itself. Going beyond the politics of recognition, La Hora Mixteca also facilitated communication between migrant workers and their families divided by the border and among fragmented Mixtec-speaking migrant communities, promoting access to resources and information to seek better housing, employment, and medical support. The show also became a central node in the network of local Oaxaca musicians, providing opportunities and exposure. Carlos Mendoza attested to this, quote, "Yes, La Hora Mixteca was like a window through which we saw everyone. Not all of us are lucky enough to have been picked, but they give us a chance to play. There's not a musician here in the Central Valley who doesn't know Fidelmo Lopez. We all know him." As Lopez's show gained popularity, more requests for chilena started to trickle in. But chilena was danced at home gatherings to a live band, and had not been recorded much either in Oaxaca or in the U.S. until the last decade. Lopez encouraged local musicians to come in and record chilena, and over time, new innovative forms of chilena music started to appear. As Lopez expressed to me, quote, "La Hora Mixteca was the first firefly of the spark of chilena music in California. Now, chilena music dominates the majority of the airtime. When I visited the Radio Bilingüe studio in Fresno during broadcasting of the show, dozens of requests for chilena songs came through the phone. Lopez cried out, 'Oh, it has to be chilena. If I play something else, listeners will call in and complain.' Lopez's radio show then produced a significant unintended consequence. It gave rise to the local chilena scene, and through the heavy airplay on La Hora Mixteca, chilena gained attraction as a sonic emblem of Oaxacan heritage, along with the sound of the indigenous language. Now I turn to two figures within this emergent network of musicians to examine the variety of creative, economic, and political aspirations articulated through the cultural poetics of chilena music on the accordion. Carlos Mendoza, a multi-instrumentalist, composer, and producer, was the first person in the Central Valley to produce a full-length album of chilena songs, a radically innovative concept at the time. Mendoza is short and stout, with a broad smile and an easy laugh. He came to California about 25 years ago to work in the fields. Now in his early 50s, he lives in a modest house with his wife and his seven children. So next to him is my collaborator, Julie King. And this is actually his grandchild. He's built a recording studio in his garage, where he's produced seven all-chilena albums, as well as several albums of Norteño music. His innovative first All Chilena album featured the saxophone as the melody instrument, yet another original move. Although it met with some criticism at first, the album became a sensation locally. CDs sold well around the area, and requests for Mendoza Chilena came in constantly at La Hora Mixteca. It was not until several years later, in the early 2000s, when Mendoza decided to release another All Chilena album, this time on the accordion. Mendoza grew up listening to Norteño music on the accordion, while his parents listened to Chilena with longing for their home state. By the time he and his brothers formed a band when he was 8, the natural choice of music was Norteño music, not Chilena. After arriving in the U.S. in the late 1980s, he spent a decade gigging after long hours in the field, playing Norteño music for the non-indigenous Mexicans who speak Spanish as the first language. I call them mainstream Mexicans for the lack of a better word. Under the group name, a group name Real del Norte, as if to claim authenticity of the music from northern Mexico, or perhaps to downplay his southern roots. A shift happened gradually, however, in the past 10 years. As his longing for Oaxaca and regional pride grew stronger, Mendoza became committed to reinterpreting and producing Chilena music under the moniker of Real de Oaxaca, taking pride in his musical promotion of indigenous Oaxacan identity. For him, whose sense of Oaxacan heritage is grounded in the constant migration movement itself, reinterpreting Chilena, a genre that is also inherently migrant from Chile to Oaxaca to California, with the accordion was a creative process in which he musically negotiated and articulated the complex sense of belonging and longing as a migrant Oaxacan living in a new land. The success of Mendoza's innovative reinterpretations of Chilena music has allowed him to retire from the field, and now he makes his living as a home studio recording engineer and producer during the weekdays, while performing at parties and venues on the weekends. Mendoza recognizes the importance of music making not only as a means of expressing identity politics, but also a means of livelihood. Quote, "And we do it so they'll buy it too. Because music doesn't live by grace. We have to earn enough for our hamburgers. We don't have the fortune to be famous, but if I eat a piece of bread or drink soda, I owe all of it to music." End quote. The formation of newly reinterpreted Chilena then allowed Mendoza to fulfill both his creative and economic aspirations, while asserting his renewed sense of Oaxacan indigeneity in the face of doubly marginalized social reception he has endured in decades of working in the field in the U.S. So moving on to the last actor. But not all Chilena musicians who followed suit have the same view of the accordion in Chilena music, nor did they achieve similar kind of a success. A family band consisting of brothers and nephews, Los Yukinos are of a different generation from Lopez and Mendoza. Mostly in their mid-20s and early 30s, the band members arrived in the Central Valley only 6 years ago, from the Oaxacan village Yucuquimi de Huacampo. Farm workers by day and gigging musicians by night, Los Yukinos play a variety of gigs, from mainstream Mexican nightclubs to Oaxacan family functions. Mendoza has been producing Los Yukinos' Chilena albums in the past few years, and they have been getting a lot of airtime on La Hora Mixteca. So I'll play you a track quickly. We'll be right back. within Mexico exposed him to Norteño music early in life. Los Chiquinos came directly from their village to California. The accordion wasn't a sound inherent to their migrant experiences. Rather, it was a sound of mainstream Mexico in the U.S., and they chose to embrace it strategically. Los Chiquinos picked up the accordion and Norteño repertoire to expand their digging opportunities after arriving in California. I first heard Los Chiquinos in February 2009 at the nightclub Aldo's in Fresno. Inside, a big dance floor was surrounded by shiny mirrors, red lights, and the reflections of spinning disco balls. It was a Saturday night, and people were there to dance. The women wore high heels and short skirts. Almost all men wore cowboy hats, perfect jeans, and dressed in cowboy boots with very pointy toes. There, catering to the crowd of predominantly middle-class Mexicans, Los Chiquinos performed a primarily Norteño repertoire. The accordion was front and center, its red and green bells expanding and contracting rapidly, rhinestones glittering under the flashing lights. At one point during the first set, conscious of our presence, the journalists, the band announced that they would perform a Chilena song, sung in Mixtec. But this was not a Oaxacan crowd, perhaps not familiar with the Mixtec language or the dance style to go with the fast triplet feel of Chilena music. The crowd stayed seated and silent for the song. It was not until Los Chiquinos switched back to a Norteño tune that couples got up to dance. Hands on waists, cowboy boots tapping, high heels twirling in a jumpy two-step. This event highlighted the demarcation between Oaxacan field workers and the mainstream Mexican middle-class crowd at Aldo's, for whom the unfamiliar beats of Chilena and Mixtec language embodied both class and ethnic differences. While this anecdote shows Chilena as a potential sonic marker of difference, Chilena on the accordion has also given rise to an unexpected alliance among field workers from various regions. Fast forward two years, on my visit back to Fresno in September 2011, Los Chiquinos was playing quite a different game. Patricio Vasquez, the 25-year-old accordionist of the band, organized a dance party for the local farmers in an open-air community space behind a humble Oaxacan family home on the outskirts of Fresno. It was a fundraising event where the proceeds were to be donated to the local church in the hometown village in Oaxaca. Los Chiquinos opened the night to be followed by three more bands playing an assortment of Chilena, Norteño, Cumbia, and other genres. Around 180 people were in attendance, the majority of whom were men, from teenagers to those in their 60s. Delicious homemade pozole and tamales were served, and as the night progressed, dozens of empty beer cans filled tabletops along with cut lines that accompanied heavy tequila drinking. Vasquez told me that they were all field workers, many from Oaxaca, but also from other regions, including Guerrero, Sinaloa, and Michoacán. Bands spoke to the crowd in Spanish throughout the night instead of Mixtec, and gave a shout out to Mexican states represented in the crowd by creating a call and response. Raise your hands if you're from Oaxaca, from Michoacán, what we witnessed that night was quite the opposite of a club event at Aldo's. Whenever the band switched to Norteño, Cumbia, or another dance to Chilena, a swirl of people got up to the floor and danced. Chilena isn't a couple's dance. Dancers are scattered across the dance floor, digging the heels into the dirt ground with a rhythmic bounce in their knees. And Chilena beat and accordion sounds got people dancing, not just Oaxaca. Fernando Pablo, the guitarist and the leader of Los Chiquinos, noted, quote, "Yes, a lot of people from other states of the Mexican Republic are now getting familiar with Chilena music here, because now it's coming in stronger. The people from other states discriminated against us for being Oaxacans, for being small or not speaking Spanish well and all that. But now it's changing a bit. It's favoring the people from Oaxaca for our music. Yeah, it's also the kind of music that people from other states like." Just within 2 years between my first visit and more recent visit, Chilena has taken root not just among Oaxacans, but their fellow field workers from other regions of Mexico. Mendoza's words may help explain Chilena's growing popularity I witnessed. Quote, "Because the accordion is for us, it's more universal. The accordion in the world of Norteño music, it's the same from Texas to Oaxaca. So in bringing the Chilena to the accordion, I apply them to people from all over Mexico." In other words, although Chilena itself may be explicitly Oaxacan, The sound of the accordion became a common denominator for farm workers from various regions of Mexico, making Chilena more accessible to non-Oaxacans. To put it in ethnomusicologist Kay Chalamet's terms, the reinterpreted Chilena is a sound that bridges farm workers from various regions, going beyond community of descent, as in community united through historically grounded collective identity, and producing a community of affinity, as in social proximity forged through individual preferences, through the sound of the accordion. So that's the Alice Yukino's playing, and those are the dancers. So in these three stories that I just told you, we just saw how reinterpretation and circulation of new Chilena articulate diverse experiences and aspirations of Oaxaca migrant workers in the Central Valley. Lopez hears accordion-based Chilena as the sonic signifier of his pride for indigenous Oaxacan identity, a musical symbol for the cultural cultural advocacy work. Mendoza, for whom the sound of the accordion is constitutive of his migrant identity, performed his sense of belonging as an Oaxacan on constant migration through his accordion-based Chilena. Los Yukinos strategically incorporated the accordion to embrace and appeal to mainstream Mexican-Americanness. The instrument affords Los Yukinos the economic opportunities to flexibly cater to various musical demands on weekend nights, while also enabling them to organize the community of Mexican field workers from various regions to raise funds to support their hometown on the other side of the border. Here, in the process of rendering the Oaxacan regional music of Chilena on the accordion, we hear three forces at work. First, for Oaxacans working alongside other Mexicans who identify with Norteño music and being hailed as Mexican at large by the US society, incorporation of the accordion into their music meant an embracing of the sonic index of mainstream Mexicanness. Secondly, for indigenous Oaxacans who are racialized and discriminated against by the mainstream Mexicans in the US, performance of Chilena amplified the sense of belonging as an indigenous Oaxacan. Third, at the same time, Chilena has also taken on new meanings as sonic emblem of the recent migrant farm workers from other areas of Mexico, whose regional differences have been articulated through the sound of newly rendered Chilena, forging a new sense of affective alliance. The network of listening audience has expanded across the border too. The transnational network of listeners of Darío Bilingüe across the US and in Mexico have been listening to and requesting the new Chilena produced in the Central Valley. A question emerges here though, about whether and how the emergence of reinterpreted Chilena has changed the social reception of Oaxacans. Echoing the positive outlook of Fernando Pablo of Los Yukinos, who saw the popularity of Chilena as a sign of wider acceptance of Oaxacan indigeneity in the Mexican community, Lopez also gave me a hopeful answer to my question about the political efficacy of Chilena as a musical form of cultural advocacy. Lopez believed that the increased cultural visibility and audibility of Oaxacanness in the reinterpreted Chilena on his radio show changed the social status of the indigenous population and sees possibilities for more change. Lopez said, "Unfortunately, the discrimination that we face is from our Mexican brothers. That's what we face down there in our village, and let's say we came up here and it's the same thing we face. Here it's with our fellow Mexicans that we have to educate. We have to mold them so that they see the colorful indigenous cultures in Mexico today. But we've eradicated a minimum part of the discrimination through the radio and the music," end quote. Unlike Lopez and Los Yukinos, Mendoza has a rather skeptical attitude. For him, the increased popularity of Chilena has not made the socially marginalized position of indigenous Oaxacans any better. Mendoza, reflecting on the harsher discrimination of that he faced back in Mexico, saw Chilena as simply a means of negotiating a sense of self, a sonic index of their Oaxacanness, but not a politically effective tool in gaining more recognition. Mendoza said, "But Chilena on the accordion hasn't even benefited us in regard to discrimination. Chilena music simply identifies us, that's all. That we're more identifiable because there is our music, they listen to it here, they listen to it there, and that's it." The disagreement between Mendoza and Lopez went beyond their view of the political efficacy of the Chilena's cultural work. Lopez has organized a first Chilena contest, inviting groups from the Central Valley and Oregon. But Mendoza remained critical. Mendoza declined Lopez's request to be the judge at the contest, critiquing the calcifying tendencies of such events that simply provide a commercial showcase for the Norteño bands that barely play Chilena music. There were aesthetic disagreements as well. Lopez, while showing ample respect, considered Mendoza's Chilena to have too much Norteño flavor in his accordion ornamentation. And this is also a slight sort of jab at Mendoza's inability to speak Mixtec because he grew up mostly in northern Mexico. While recognizing Mendoza's contribution as the initial impetus to the budding Chilena scene in the Central Valley, Lopez praised the latest Los Yukinos All Chilena album, which did not feature the accordion. Just within 2 years, I sensed the change in the inclination for both Los Yukinos and Lopez to prefer the classic instrumentation of violin and guitar over accordion in their interpretation of Chilena. These constantly shifting discourses, aesthetics, and sentiments generated by the newly reinterpreted Chilena highlight the contradictions and frictions, as well as new possibilities produced through the accordion in the lived realities of the Oaxaca migrants, who are creatively reimagining their heritage through the instrument. The unique articulation of Chilena, the accordion, and the airwave has had profound and varying effective social and economic effects on Oaxaca migrant workers. Precisely because its meanings and sounds are malleable and contestable as it's developing. What we are witnessing here is a generativity of cultural practices in a state of emergence. First of the three broader points I'd like to highlight as I zoom out and recapitulate my talk. As an anthropologist, Kathleen Stewart calls our attention to tracking the cultural poetics of the vitality of a moving object. In this talk, I hope to have captured the dynamic nature of newly rendered Chilena, a musical practice constantly in the process of transnational circulation, reinterpretation, and re-emergence, as it animates the social and cultural lives of Oaxacan field workers in California. In its early stage of formation, Chilena on the accordion has enabled not simply a mode of expression of multi-layered subjectivity, but also a provisional and ever-shifting network of actors and audiences that have given rise to forms of cultural advocacy, new economic opportunities, and new affective alliances among field workers. It's precisely the state of being emergent that enabled a form of cultural politics that articulated the diverse and sometimes conflicting creative, social, and economic aspirations among the Oaxacan farm workers. These new renditions of Chilena on the accordion, who play and dance to these new renditions of Chilena on the accordion. Literary critic and cultural theorist Raymond Williams calls this productive but unstable and malleable moment when the meanings have not socially been coded, the politics have emerged. Although Chilena has not gained presence in a mainstream radio or record industries, tending ethnographically to the cultural politics and poetics of these emergent moments allows us to hear the creative expressions and contradictions of the lives of Oaxacan migrants in the U.S. A second broader point I'd like to comment on is the format of this project. I want to offer a few reflections on the process of producing this documentary and its efficacy as a kind of musical advocacy at the intersection of musicology and journalism, and one might call it applied ethnomusicology or public ethnomusicology. Although radio documentary has not been widely accepted as a major mode of scholarly engagement for ethnomusicologists since the time of Alan Lomax, I have found this format to be a generative mode of scholarly and public engagement, which fosters collaborative relationships among scholars, journalists, and communities. I can't overemphasize the values of the collaborative processes in the production of knowledge. The funding agency required that our project involve humanities advisors. Thus, we were in close contact with scholars such as George Lipsitz, Josh Kuhn, Alejandro Madrid, Scott Marcus, Deborah Wong, and Mark DeWitt, all specialized in various accordion musics or issues that we featured, to ensure that the documentary has, quote, intellectual depth, and this is the language of the funding agents. The constant feedback I received from them guided the collaborative production process between co-producer and myself. This point adds to the debate on the value of co-authored scholarship in humanities academic culture, where single authorship is still the norm. And also the question of whether and how such public ethnomusicology projects in non-traditional medium should be evaluated in academia. Methodologically, this radio documentary project provided a productive opportunity for me to recalibrate the role sound plays in the process of analyzing ethnographic data. This project gave me an opportunity to tackle some of the key issues that anthropologist Stephen Feld raises in order to, quote, do anthropology of sound in sound, end quote. Letting the sound do the work of raising questions, letting themes emerge, and producing your argument in sound was an extremely challenging and creatively fulfilling process that has consequently informed the way I think through my other projects in general. Keeping the wider outreach to the general public in mind while producing this documentary challenged me to stay vigilant in our responsibilities to render the knowledge accessible so that it can feed back into the communities we featured. The ethical question of what to do with the knowledge produced through fieldwork within the community has long been a subject of debate in ethnomusicology as well as in anthropology. The Society of Ethnomusicology has identified a branch of the discipline called applied ethnomusicology, which is defined as working ethnomusicology that puts music to use in a variety of contexts, academic and otherwise, including education, cultural policy, conflict resolution, medicine, arts programming, and community music. I personally prefer public ethnomusicology rather than applied musicology as a term. The term applied assumes a false divide that keeps unprefixed ethnomusicology away from the real world, when fieldwork and pedagogy are always inherently an applied practice. The International Council of the Traditional Music pushes the definition of or public ethnomusicology further. For them, it is an approach guided by principles of social responsibility, which extends the usual academic goal of broadening and deepening knowledge and understanding towards solving concrete problems and towards working in both inside and beyond typical academic contexts. The ICTM study group on applied ethnomusicology advocates the use of ethnomusicological knowledge in influencing social interaction and course of cultural change. In other words, applied or public ethnomusicology involves the production of knowledge and recirculation of that knowledge back into the community studied, often in a way that seeks to advance community-defined goals. Hence, public ethnomusicology might be understood as both a discipline and an ethical point of view, which results in knowledge as well as in action. In this light, our documentary project falls short of meeting this goal. While the documentary has distributed knowledge about the musical and social nuances and dynamics of community whose voices are otherwise underrepresented, and raised awareness of the issues and struggles some of these communities faced, it has not accomplished enough to engage deeply with the local communities. It was our goal to have our documentary dubbed in Spanish and put on air on Radio Bilingüe, which unfortunately faced financial constraints and has not happened. And in small ways, we may have also contributed to individual success, as in Carlos Mendoza's, he got more exposed to other audiences, and he said that he's been selling more CDs. We invited him to also speak with us at California Historical Society in San Francisco, and he had a chance to exchange with music and dialogues with the public in San Francisco who may not have any idea about his music or his community. But in order to practice the kind of public ethnomusicology that ICTM's definition aspires to, there's much work to be done. And I advocate for more sustained, long-term relationships with members and organizations of the Oaxacan communities to affect cultural changes that they have identified. And last and a final point, the notion of social life and musical instruments. I hope that this ethnographic analysis of the accordion among Oaxaca migrant workers has highlighted how the accordion is not incidental to, but rather constitutive of, social interactions and relations. For them, the accordion is not only a symbol of Oaxacan or Mexican identities, but also a force that propelled the emergence of a new transcultural creative practices, enabling some Oaxacan musicians to negotiate and reshape the complex transnational forces that inform their everyday life. In revisiting the question I posed earlier about how to account for the agency of objects without undermining human subjectivities, I align myself with ethnomusicologist Maria Sanovitsky's call for critical organology, which enables us to think with and through sound-making objects ethnographically in culturally specific contexts. I particularly find her formulation of sound-making object as simultaneously extracorporeal and metaphorically an extension of one's body and voice to be helpful. The musical instrument, as both external and internal to the performer's body, can at once be conceived as an agent for objects, an embodiment of symbolic meanings and histories, and a nodal point of social relations. By considering musical instruments as integral to the analysis of sound makers and listeners, and by taking its material presence and affective force as seriously as symbolic discursive effects, we can gain new and nuanced insights into the cultural poetics and material presence of the musical instruments. In closing, I'd like to leave you with one of my favorite quotes from our commentator, George Lipsitz. In some ways, witnesses have to speak. Testimonies have to be heard. People cannot remain totally silent, but they often don't have citizenship. They don't have the English language, and they don't have the ability to write. They work with the tools that are open to them in the arenas that they can access. So an instrument, and especially an instrument like the accordion, which is an incredible storehouse of memory, many different emotions and many different ways of being and thinking about the world, is a logical form to express those contradictions of immigrant life. Thank you.